Not a ship stirred on the broad waters of the river. Camp was pitched on a sandy strip over the water line in a break of the undergrowth. Most of the Itibirayans wanted to rest and observe the neighborhood, but Satura decided to visit the night market of this, the largest coastal town of Colombia. We found an isolated spot, with wild hedges covering the river embankment. Like most larger towns in the South American republics, it had a busy nightlife. The markets, for example, keep open until there isn't a customer left to buy. Most markets have their fair share of fruit and soft drink vendors. It must have been at 11:30 p.m. when we arrived at one of the filthiest markets I have ever seen. Rotten fruit and banana leaves were strewn all over the street. But, there seemed to be a large selection of fruit and soft drinks on the stalls. That was good. We might find something different here, something to the Itibiran taste, I thought, with a sarcastic sense of humor. The display of fruit is one of the features of Colombia, I told Satura. Undoubtedly you will find something to interest you. Satura went from fruit stall, making a minute inspection of the fruit that was offered for sale. Now, a market seller, all over the world, always has the same thing in common. They don't like customers touching and inspecting their goods, turning over the stock without buying anything. So as to prevent any scene that might be embarrassing to my friend, I rummaged in my packets and found some Peruvian coins that, besides some bills, I had left from the time I was in Lima. These I handed to Satura. He had no money of his own, and I told him to buy what he wanted. Satura displayed a naivete that was astounding for one so astute as himself. He inspected the fruit, turning and prodding, but he did not buy anything. Instead, he offered a stall seller money merely for the privilege of inspecting the stock, smiled politely, then moved on to the next stall. Each stallholder accepted the money with alacrity, and did not press any fruit onto Satura. I suppose they looked upon the money as a tip given to them by an eccentric foreigner. I am sure they must have thought of Satura as the typical American gringo. We wandered through the town and found one or two other smaller markets. Suddenly, my nostrils were assailed by the most heavenly aroma, that of roasting chicken. All the longing for good, solid food came back to me. I had been living on the Itibirayan diet. Mark you, I was fit enough on it, but I recently had this craving for solid, homely good food. The smell of the roasting chicken brought on that longing once more. I soon tracked that heavenly smell down to its source. A chicken roaster had set up his stall in the corner of one of the smaller markets. Half a dozen chickens were turning on spits over a glowing charcoal fire. I reached in my pocket for my wallet, extracted a 50-sol Peruvian bill, and gave the Colombian chicken roaster a lesson in Peruvian currency. We agreed that the bill was the equivalent of about 30 pesos, more than enough to buy half a succulent chicken, which the man proceeded to hand me. The chicken roasting Colombian even gave me 3 pesos bills of his money and immediately, with a muttered word of apology to Satura, I ate that half chicken there and then. I was ravenous. Never has chicken tasted so good as in that marketplace, with the night sky above and Satura by my side as I tore strips of juicy breast from my half chicken. I reckon it took me about as long to eat that half chicken as the voyage to the river delta had taken about 5-7 minutes. Satura was amazed at the caveman's gluttony, for that was what it was. Then I saw a look of sadness cross his face. I knew what he was thinking, that it was a crime to kill a bird just for a human being to eat it. At that moment, I must confess, I was out of sympathy with Itibirayan philosophy. All I was interested in was picking the bones clean. What was it Cervantes said? See if you can find a knife, and look out for one or two chickens, and then, good appetite. A knowing bird, that's Cervantes. I just didn't eat trouble about a knife. Only Satura's now disapproving look spoiled the pleasure of that half chicken. Soon after we left the chicken stall, we ran into Mr. Hua. He told us that he found himself unable to sleep, and had, therefore, followed us to the market, hoping to meet up with us. They asked me if I knew about another market open that late, and I replied that I remembered from a previous visit to Barranquilla that I had seen one down by a beautiful church. So we went there, and it was in this market that we came across the guayaba. This proved to be the only fruit on sale in Barranquilla that was not known to my friends from Itibiratu. Have you tasted this fruit? Satara questioned me. Yes. It has a bittersweet flavor, really delightful. I also mentioned that the guayaba has a lot of seeds, which makes it less popular than it otherwise would be. But it is fit for consumption? Satara wanted to know. I said, many people make a drink from it, rather than go to the trouble of eating the fruit. In this respect, it is like the ordinary orange or lemon. It is not difficult to cultivate. They both wanted to know immediately, and I told them, I think not, although I am no expert. I do know that it grows all the way from Mexico, down through the Central American countries into the north of Peru. A very fair spread. With this, my friends seemed to be satisfied and decided to take it back to the plantation laboratories. Again, I had to pay, this time with the change from the chicken. They chose the most perfect fruit, but then Satara asked me if I could not find the specimens of the guayaba tree. This was an impossible thing, as it was past midnight and most of the fruit sellers were beginning to close their stands. Nevertheless, we spent an hour or so wandering through the night markets of Barranquilla looking for a plant dealer, but without success. It seemed as if my friends never got tired. I was feeling sleepy, and, therefore, suggested that we return to the temporary camp, have a few hours' sleep, and then resume the search for a plant dealer in the morning. I was up very early in the morning. Shipping was already shuffling its way along the Magdalena. I had no objection to being found camped out on the embankment, but I thought it might embarrass my Itibirayan friends if they were. So, I woke the rest of the camp. Within a short time they all were safely inside the two boats. With the exception of the guard on duty, they had all had a good night's rest. They just never worried about being detected. Of course, with security measures entirely different in Colombia as in India, the Itibirayans did not dare to enter Barranquilla during daytime. Perhaps they had stayed the night just to keep me company. I was very pleased to find proof of their trust when they agreed to meet me at the same place in order to pick me up the following morning, at the same time, just after dawn. I watched my friends disappear in an upstream direction and then made my way back leisurely to the center of the town. As there were no buses that early, I had to walk almost 1 hour. The first thing I did was to have a human breakfast, a normal breakfast with eggs, toast, marmalade and good Colombian coffee, which I consider the best. Barranquilla was astir. It is a large, thriving town that has grown enormously since I first knew it. My first call was to the offices of the Iberian Airlines, where I found a copy of the local trade directory. I checked under the heading Nurseryman, there was not a single entry. Out I went into the bustling street, hailed a taxi, and asked the driver the best place to buy a few plants. He knew several places, so off we went. I drew a complete blank. Not one of the half dozen dealers I visited stocked the guayaba. Indeed, one or two thought that I was crazy trying to buy samples, when all I had to do was to go up country for a few miles and cut a few for myself. Guayaba. The last place I visited with the friendly cabbie was owned by a little old woman. She didn't stock the plant, but she thought that if I crossed the river to the town of Santa Marta, I would stand a very good chance of finding a place where this particular plant was sold. I thanked my informant, and the cabbie drove me down to the ferry terminal. Not too far from the terminal, but still in the town, I noticed a store that sold the latest Japanese cameras. It occurred to me that, despite the dislike the Itibirans had for cameras, they would hardly object if I went back with some samples of the plant for them and a new camera for myself. So I told the driver to take me to the Hotel Central, where an obliging cashier changed a Peruvian bill of large denomination into smaller bills. Then I went to the store and bought a Japanese camera. Back inside the taxi, I told the driver to return to the ferry, and then made a quick check of the camera. It seemed in excellent order, so I loaded it with a roll of film. By this time we were at the ferry terminal. I paid off the driver and added a handsome tip. The trip across the delta was most enjoyable. The water was placid, the sun hot, the people friendly. I shot several frames, and reflected on the amazing sequence of events that had sent me searching for the guayaba plant in a Colombian town for some visitors from another planet. I disembarked at the peaceful delta and took a bus to Santa Marta, about 25 miles from the huge river. Santa Marta is a pleasant little town, and I soon found a nursery. There were a couple of amiable Indians in charge of the place, and they let me wander around inspecting the stock. There were flowers in profusion, palm trees, fruit trees, orchids in pots, but there was no sign of a guayaba plant. Disappointed, I explained my plight to the nurseryman. They told me that there were one or two other plant firms in the town, but they did not think any of them stocked the tree. However, one of them knew of a large private garden. He had seen the plant growing in that garden. Perhaps the owner might let me have a few cuttings. Together with the nurseryman, I hailed a cruising taxi. I had been given the approximate position of the private garden, and we had little difficulty in finding it. The house where I made my inquiry was a substantial building, in the typical Spanish colonial style. The lady of the house took me into the grounds of the house. There were plenty of guayabas, and she let me have all the cuttings I needed. She insisted on helping me pack the roots and buds in sacking, and would take very little for the rather large bundle with which I eventually left. I had time to kill before the bus left for the ferry, so I placed the roots in the luggage office of the bus station and explored the town for an hour or so. In good time, I rescued the guayabas, boarded the ferry, and returned to Barranquilla. It was about 10:30 p.m. and a long time before dawn. I couldn't very well go to an hotel for bed and breakfast. Besides, I didn't want to let the precious plants out of my sight. So I spent an uneasy night wandering round the town, sitting in coffee shops clutching the cuttings, wailing for the first light of dawn. The first part of the night was not too bad. At about 1 a.m. I found myself back in that same small marketplace I had visited the previous evening. The smell of roasting chicken waited in my nostrils. I bought a further half chicken, wedged in the plants between my legs, and this time ate the chicken much more slowly. These, our teeth, I thought, are made for chopping meat and not for sipping fine juices, nor vegetarian delicacies. The hours after midnight dragged. Again, all the stalls closed. If I had been a policeman, I would have been very suspicious of the lone foreigner walking the streets of Barranquilla hugging a parcel of plants. Fortunately, I did not see anybody in authority, and, just as dawn was breaking, I made my way along the riverfront to the rendezvous on the embankment. I had scarcely reached the agreed spot when Satura, all by himself, came fussing up in the silent speedboat. I managed to clamber aboard, and Satura immediately opened the magnetic power regulator. The comfort of the boat made me sleep immediately for a full hour. Suddenly, we were all aboard Satura's control ship, and he invited me to go along with him to his control room, which is situated in the middle section of the spaceship. "Well done," he congratulated me. "We will take very good care of you and the cuttings. I see no reason why we shouldn't have a trial guayaba plot and then send off our own cuttings to Itibiratu to see if they will stand transplanting." Back at the plantation, as I had feared, Satura took a special interest in the camera I had bought. He told me about Amatmena, the science of soul based on ancient beliefs. Not that my friends believe in reincarnation, but, definitely, they do not care for photos and pictures because of certain implications. I understood that, besides certain security restrictions, they simply do not care about their looks. They are devoid of all vanity, pride or feeling of superiority. I suppose, it is a religious thing, to avoid contempt. During all the time, and particularly where Xiti was concerned, I never saw them use a mirror. Satura kept the camera and gave it back to me before my return to Lima on the 27th of February. He never touched the film, and the shots I took on the ferry to Santa Marta are all I have from this trip. Footnote: in this connection I must mention that I observed that the return of the Iberon explorers coincided with the departure of the Magdalena Rivadello expedition. I am sure that these people never keep two missions going at the same time, even though I was told that they are able to supervise several differently located plantation research labs. And today this ferry has been replaced by a road of embankments and bridges across the bay, which can be seen on a Google Maps and on map above Chapter 13. Another civilization's prayer. Back at the Mirim base, the chief botanists, one of them a woman astronaut scientist, on the 23rd and 24th of February made a serious investigation of the fruit and seeds, as well as the plants I was able to buy in Santa Marta. Their research work lasted 2 complete days, dissecting, analyzing, bedding the plants and savoring their flavor. All this was reported to Itibiratu. I have always eschewed to predict things, but this interest in a health and life-spending plant I do not believe exaggerated. Perhaps future generations will do what the Itibirayans did. I know, at the present time, a multitude of war material inventing geniuses keep us busy, and the serious investigation of a tropical fruit may appear to be the joke of a bad comedy, but isn't it life itself that would make such a comedy of health viable? It was Mr. Hua who took the greatest interest and who took me under his wing to show me the run of the laboratories and answer my questions. I already described how they laid out the plantation under huge green protective sheet, but I have given little indication of the extremes to which my friends went in order that their flavor stations should operate under the best conditions. For example, air filters and humidifiers had been installed at strategic points so that, no matter what the weather, the plant biologists could always have controlled weather conditions inside the flavor station. The main path through the plantation complex separated the station into 2 sections, each of which was made self-contained by means of colored dividing sheets that were rigged 3 high. In front of the actual biology research laboratory was a wing consisting of several large tents. In these tents were many vegetable guinea pigs, which had been brought from Itibiratu, had been transplanted, and had then been used as required for grafting onto samples of earth vegetation. The object of the grafting operations was to obtain as fine a strain of individual plant life as it was possible to get by uniting the best of earth types with the best of Itibiratu types. The biology research laboratory was Hua's pride and joy. It was a series of interconnecting marquees, stretching for some 350 feet, 115 meters, and was some 60 feet, 20 meters, wide. It was divided off into experimental bays, rather like the operating rooms of hospitals. In these bays, the Itibiran biologists went to work on plants in much the same way that a doctor goes to work on a patient. The finest instruments were used to dissect the cells of the plants. The veins and stems of the plants were put under close scrutiny. X-ray pictures were taken, not the normal plate-type X-rays but a continuous record, rather like a roll of film. The plant surgeons, for this was what the biologists really were, could watch on separate left and right-hand panels let into the wall. On these panels, the eye computer projected a continuous report of the dissection as it proceeded. These television-type panels were studied throughout the entire process by special observation officers, who indicated their opinions to a chief scientific officer who controlled the actual work itself. The accommodation was very gay. Religious symbols of Itibiratu were scattered throughout the complex in order to remind the biologists of their homeland. Work was never carried out standing. The biologists sat at their work in the Oriental manner. Despite the excellent atmospheric conditions within the various sections of the laboratories and grafting unit, I found that by the end of the day I was feeling rather worn out. Xiti noticed this, and suggested that, before going to the craft for our evening meal, we should stroll across to the bath tents and relax for a short while. This sounded most agreeable, so she had a word with her brother, and we left the bay where she had been working, and walked the short distance to the baling units. Mention has already been made on several occasions to the love of water that the Itabirans had. Some historians refer to empires which have developed along mighty rivers as riparian empires. So, in years to come, when regular communications have been established between Earth and Itabiratu, future historians will, I think, refer to my friends as the product of an extraterrestrial riparian civilization. My friends normally bail at least twice a day, before going to work and when work is finished in the late afternoon. Their bailing habits are a combination of the Finnish and Japanese. The normal bath is like the Finnish sauna unit, and they have both wet and dry bath units. Because of their lack of inhibitions about nakedness, men and women bath together. It was indeed a relaxing half hour. The tropical birds were sweetening the air with their music. The scent of hundreds of different plants invaded the nostrils. The cleansing water relaxed the body. I noticed that Xity, who is meticulous about her personal hygiene, was scrubbing furiously as if she had done filthy work in the laboratories. I remarked upon this, and she frowned a little. "Can you not smell?" she demanded. "Smell what?" I wondered. But then she told me to my face that I had eaten meat. I laughed like an idiot. On two occasions I had eaten chicken in Barranquilla. Xity grinned and pulled a face at me. She looked so adorable that I almost forgot the presence of other people in the bath unit. In the comparative cool of the early evening, we sauntered back to the spacecraft. It was here, I suppose, that the Itabirans showed their gift for domesticity. The dining quarter and health lounges were bright with decorations. Lovely, soft divans and deep cushions, gay with floral patterned covers, invited relaxation after the day's work. I admired the way in which the women, some being the wives of the astronauts, who shared similar jobs to the men all day, could shed their technical role during off-duty hours and revert to an essential feminism such as one experiences when in Japan. They even took it upon themselves to see to the running of the domestic side of the expedition. We spent a pleasant evening in the mess before making our way back to Xity's quarters. For the first time since I had met this remarkable woman, I said with her the evening prayer, the first intercosmic prayer to God available to us human beings on Earth. The prayer was begun and ended with the word Talayan uttered in a reverential way. It is both an invocation and a valediction. The whole prayer, which I translated into English, is, I think, so much more meaningful than the normal everyday prayer, with its constant demands for this and for that. Here it is: "Let me be prepared to fear nothing, my one and only God nature. Let me stay strong, and honest to myself and others. Let me be prepared for kindness at all times, so that I cause no pain to others or myself. Let me, only one in cosmos, keep thy laws. Let me abstain from all excesses, let me be true to myself and others. Let me observe the law of peaceful death." Chapter 14. Death of a Monkey. The dining quarter and health lounges were bright with decorations. Lovely, soft divans and deep cushions, gay with floral patterned covers, invited relaxation after the day's work. I admired the way in which the women, some being the wives of the astronauts, who shared similar jobs to the men all day, could shed their technical role during off-duty hours and revert to an essential feminism such as one experiences when in Japan. They even took it upon themselves to see to the running of the domestic side of the expedition. A rather disappointing and deplorable incident I reported in my diary on the 23rd of February, 1967. Because of this occurrence I began to ask Xity to tell me more about the life of Satara, and most of the time I spent on board the spacecraft writing the biography of Satara together with what I believe to be their cosmophilosophic religion. Easy enough it was to make the notes in several languages and using shorthand, but to put all this down in one and the same human language, not being a professional writer, will take me several years. Because of what happened on the 23rd of February, 1967, I shall do it. In the early morning of this unforgettable day, while I was still asleep, Mr. Satara, used to a different sleeping habit, had ventured outside the plantation to pay a short visit to the Indian plantation helpers. I think I have mentioned before that on the outer fringes from the Mirim headquarters, the tribesmen had built some provisional palm huts for their women and children. With the exception of Turu, the Indians liked to live with our friends because of the benefits and privileges of medical attention, the good fruit etc. the Itabirans granted. During the night, a fight between the Indians from the Linilan area and those having lived with the Mirim scientists resulted in the killing of Turu's father and another tribesman. At dawn the Linilan helpers had disappeared and the Mirim Indians made preparations for the funeral of the deceased. Perhaps the word funeral is the wrong expression because according to their custom these cannibals do not bury or cremate their dead, but instead they are roasted over a huge open fire and eaten clean to the bones. It is their view, and this reminds me very much about what the Austrian guide told me in Iquitos, that it should not be any worse to eat a dead man than a dead beast, as the roasted meat tastes the same or even better. The cannibals' funeral feast with the bodies serving for the feast itself, had to be celebrated according to an old custom. The Mirim Indians called it mang mang mang, which means the slow beating to death of an older female wool monkey. During the night they had caught a perfect specimen for this purpose, which they describe as a Neku or monkey grandmother. The unlucky old creature had fallen into one of the many banana traps and was immediately taken to the funeral fiesta. Very close to the dead bodies the monkey was then spread-eagled flat on the ground and all the tribesmen with their women and children took turns in the religious ceremony, the death of a thousand strikes. The following explanation for this cruelty was offered voluntarily by Turu. With wild gestures he indicated the demons and devils of the great jungle, not only the roasted flesh, he said, is dispatched with ceremonial gusto but the ear-piercing shrieks of the tortured animal are supposed to keep devils and demons at a distance. But why monkeys, I asked, and in particular an old female monkey? There, Turu did not know what to say, except that it just was the costumber. I was revolted by the story of the cruelty which caused this sensitive female monkey such agony. Her anguished shrieks must have been heard deep in the jungle. Merciful death at last released her from her immeasurable suffering. The Indians then placed the body with other human corpses over an open fire which consumed her wool thick hair. It must have been at this moment, I believe, that Mr. Satura arrived at the scene. The full-grown monkey grandmother, completely bare without hair, must have looked to Satura exactly like a 7 to 10 year old human girl. The roasting of Turu's relative, the smell and odor of burning meat must have given the Itabirayan biologist a shock. From Turu I found out what happened next. Not feeling embarrassed by Mr. Satura's arrival at the scene, the Indians offered him to take a bite. When he objected and ordered them to release the bodies and have them buried, the tribesmen got mad. There wasn't much Mr. Satura could do. Perhaps these Indians, in religious fanaticism, or traditional custom, were used to the habit of torturing. But what about our intelligent doctors using the same animals for vivisection? What must have gone through the mind of my beloved friend Mr. Satura that morning of February the 23rd? 1967. Only through City I know that slowly, like dream walking, he had returned to the spacecraft. We did not see the spacecraft commander for 2 full days and nights. I was told that he had retired to his quarters to hold a manor memorial for the dead monkey. He had not taken food nor drink during his voluntary fast, nor did he want to be disturbed, not even through the communication computers. It was Mr. Hua, the second in command, who had taken over security and disciplinary matters. Was Satura, besides being the most responsible scientist of the entire space fleet, also their religious leader? El asked Xity. In the evening of this unforgettable day, she finally agreed to talk about her brother and I shall include his biography with this book. There is plenty of evidence, after I had the time to study my jungle diary, that the Itabirans consider all higher developed monkeys as part of the great cosmic human family. To them, meat-eating human beings are much closer related to the big apes than to Itabiran human beings. As Xity explained it, your habit of killing children and women in war does not differ at all in cruelty from the Mirim River Indians killing an old monkey grandmother. The religious fast my friend from out of space was holding, this sit-in as our younger generation may say, he offered out of his own sincere belief in God. Again and again I asked Xity,